On Mondays, we talk with Andrew Egger, White House correspondent from The Bulwark and co-author of Morning Shots, a newsletter you can have delivered straight to your inbox. Andrew is with us today on KMOX. Good morning, Andrew.
Hey, guys. Good morning. How you doing?
Hey, we're doing okay. How's Mitch McConnell doing? Because it looks like they have released another photo of him and apparently being released from the hospital. What do we know?
Yes. So this is a new statement just breaking this morning. We have another photo of Mitch McConnell and his wife, Elaine Chao, another statement basically saying he's not yet cleared to resume, you know, going to events and things like this. They are somewhat worried about minimizing the risk of another fall, which is what put him in the hospital in the first place, but that he is well, that he's recovering. This is, again, everything that we're getting from this statement from his office and from his doctors. Mitch McConnell obviously has not been around D.C. now for a number of weeks. There have been a lot of conspiracy theories swirling around his departure. If I were Mitch McConnell, I might release a video statement. I don't know. But you can only spend so much time and effort, slapping down online rumors. And he's always been sort of notoriously private in his personal life. So I guess I kind of understand why they are taking this approach. But it's a pressing matter. I mean, they really do need him back if they're going to try to get any legislation passed for the remainder of the summer. It's a slim majority that they have in the Senate, and they need every senator they can get, even though he's obviously no longer the majority leader there.
Yeah, and you know, we've had ailing senators and representatives before, and we've had elderly senators and representatives, who are in office, I think, long past the time that they should have been. So it's not so much that Mitch McConnell being in the hospital or being absent is that unusual. Isn't most of this just all around the lack of transparency surrounding his condition?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, a lot of this is structural stuff, right? I mean, you said we've had ailing senators before, but we really are in an environment, a social media environment now, where these stories can take on a life of their own, where there's so little trust, just sort of around Congress in general and around the information that we get digitally, period. Like, a couple of years ago, a statement from a senator's office and a picture of them kind of smiling at the camera and being like, hey, I'm still here, I'm doing great. I mean, that would put a lot of rumors to rest. Now, of course, we're in this sort of AI-drenched age where trust in all of our institutions is at an all-time low, where there's a lot of people who make their money in sort of the political influencer sphere, kicking up, more and more theories about things not being the way they appear. And so there just is a higher level of scrutiny just in a vacuum. And when you add to that the fact that we are coming off of a range of stories of different lawmakers, different federal lawmakers being absent for unexplained periods of time. There was a Republican congressman who was battling depression in the hospital, whose absence was not explained for a period of months. When you're coming off of stories like Dianne Feinstein and her advanced age and just sort of deterioration, guys like Joe Biden, right? I mean, the president of the United States faced a lot of these exact same sorts of critiques just because he was quite old and there were a lot of significant questions about his health. And I think that the environment is only going to continue to grow more suspicious for all of these things. And obviously it goes along with sort of a political critique that we're seeing more and more from different people in both parties about a need for generational change in leadership, for getting younger blood in to various positions in terms of political power. And all that stuff is in the background of this, what would otherwise be just sort of a story of a pretty old lawmaker who has been hospitalized after a fall.
Oil prices have come back a bit. That's after the U.S. and Iran have some sort of, I don't know if you want to call it a ceasefire, but I guess it's that at the moment. How much staying power, though, does this pause in the strikes have?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I feel like I keep coming on this show every week and giving some version of the same basic case analysis of the president being pulled between two bad options here, right? I mean, what he would like is for his threats of violence against Iran to just shake them out of their senses and make them be willing to offer more concessions that we don't actually have to go get than we've gotten so far. But what we saw on Friday, after 2 weeks of Trump saying, well, this negotiating stuff isn't going so great, let's go back to pummeling them and see if that shakes anything loose. We got 2 weeks of that. Then last week, we got another round of really strong you know, violent rhetoric from the president. Like, if Iran keeps blowing up boats in the Strait of Hormuz, or not blowing them up, if Iran keeps firing on boats in the Strait of Hormuz, we're going to start blowing up bridges and power plants. So back to that really maximalist rhetoric. But then you get to Friday, as was reported in several outlets, the White House gets together and they basically say to the president, look, you can go through with this if you want to go through with this. And we think we will have, you know, tactical success with these operations if we do. We have a lot of military supremacy, to state it mildly, in the region. But you have to be willing to experience some blowback across a number of axes. You need to understand that, you know, that you could see mass civilian casualties with this sort of thing. You need to be worried about the level of the missiles that we have stockpiled after so many weeks and months of war, and that's getting pretty low. And what we saw then coming out of that meeting was three days now of cessation in these strikes. It's hard to read the tea leaves of this any more than we already have, in terms of, again, the White House bouncing back and forth between not getting very much at the negotiating table and then not getting very much in terms of concessions from conflict. But one thing that we have seen from Iran today was them coming out and saying, yes, we are talking with Oman right now about how to sort of regularize maritime operations inside the Strait of Hormuz. To read the tea leaves of that a little bit, these are the two countries that would basically need to strike a bilateral deal about charging tolls in the Strait of Hormuz in perpetuity going forward. So where previously we had this international waterway with free travel for any country that needed to make use of it, we are now perhaps inching toward a world where Iran and Oman control who gets in and who gets out, or at the very least get to scrape a good amount financially off the top of travel through this waterway. So very a far cry from what the United States has demanded, from where the status quo was before the beginning of this war. We will see whether it ends up being a status quo that the White House is willing to allow to persist in the aftermath of this. But again, as I keep saying, it's not clear that they have a lot of really good options short of massive military action of the sort that we haven't seen yet, and that it's not at all clear there'd be political will for in this country.
We're speaking with Andrew Egger, White House correspondent for The Bulwark. And Andrew, Senate conservatives, some led by Senator Mike Lee, are calling on Senate Majority Leader John Thune to cancel the August recess so that they can all debate President Trump's number one legislative priority, the Save America Act. Where do we stand with the Save America Act? I was getting the impression that this thing just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to pass.
Well, I don't think we've seen anything yet that should cause you to reevaluate that. I mean, the bottom line here is that this is a piece of legislation that doesn't have the votes in the Senate. There are a number of Republican lawmakers who don't like the package as a package. They might be okay with some electoral reforms. They might, for instance, be okay with some form of national voter ID. That's pretty popular, actually, among a number of people in this country. It polls very well. But as far as this particular legislative package is concerned, which Trump has really staked his reputation to and staked his entire domestic agenda to, I mean, he has repeatedly even been willing to kind of sabotage other pieces of legislation that he likes in an attempt to put more pressure on the Senate to pass this thing. But when we look at efforts like this from Mike Lee, I mean, this is, at least in my read, very much a matter of winning a certain kind of online popularity contest among Republicans. You want to be seen as the senator who is doing the most to push this top priority of the president's through. Mike Lee is taking advantage of that. He's getting a lot of accolades on Twitter for being the guy who's calling for this thing by being willing to make John Thune the bad guy. But John Thune supports the Save America Act. And this is a thing we've seen from the leader, from Leader Thune for weeks now, basically him saying, what the heck do you want me to do? Like, I'm for it. Most of my conference is for it. There's not a majority that's for it. There are a number of holdouts here that we just don't have the votes to pass this. If the White House is that concerned about passing this piece of legislation, it should get those senators on the phone, and it should be putting the pressure on them. Why am I the bad guy here is kind of the line that Thune has had to take. But I mean, we were talking about McConnell a little bit ago. It's really hard. It's really hard to be sort of the face of what is seen as a Republican establishment in this extremely anti-establishment moment. That's true in both parties, but it is certainly true of the MAGA movement right now, of the current Republican Party, because the president has sort of seen fit to cast his pretty stalled out domestic agenda as a factor, not of him, you know, pushing for legislation that just doesn't have majority support in the Senate, but as, you know, some sort of shadow Republican establishment still sort of working to frustrate him behind the scenes.
But also there was this this bill coming out of the House, the Stop Insider Trading Act, which I think most of us are kind of on board with the idea of that. However, they attached an amendment to it, which is basically the SAVE Act. So they put them together and that passed. But most Democrats, if not all of them, voted against it. So what about that bill? Does that have much chance of ultimately becoming law?
I don't think that there's anything that is look, anything could happen, right? I don't think it is very likely that we are going to see the current SAVE Act in its current permutation attached to any rider that will force it through. I think what we may see, and there has been some chatter about this in various parts of the Senate, is maybe they try to carve it up a little bit. Maybe they try to find some portions of the SAVE Act and sort of triangulate for, well, what's a elections legislative package that could get some of these Republican holdouts, could maybe even get a couple of Democratic votes, but would still be enough to sort of placate the president and let him move on, you know, mentally and emotionally onto any number of these other things. I mean, we're in a weird moment right now because Republicans have basically passed one piece of legislation in this whole first year and a half that they've had a trifecta in the government, that they've controlled the House and the Senate and the White House. And that was the One Big Beautiful Bill last year, which did a lot of stuff, but which has been kind of a tough sell. I mean, there was some political polling just out this morning basically saying a lot of people, when they think of that bill, they're like, yeah, that probably helped some people out financially, but it didn't do that much for me. And Republicans have had a hard time making the connection between that and any increase in prosperity. So they're looking for other things, you know, other legislative wins they might be able to notch this summer before everybody's really done and really just back in their districts campaigning. And meanwhile, you have the president really singularly fixated on this this elections bill, this Save America Act. And there's this real disconnect between what most Republican legislators would like to see, which is something, some new win somewhere on affordability or something that's sort of populist like this, like what you were just talking about, insider trading type stuff. And it has been an enormous amount of labor for House and Senate leadership to try to find some common ground with the White House on this. And so far they're coming up empty. So we'll see what happens. But it's been a source of a lot of frustration for a lot of Republicans right now.
Andrew, I feel like I'm just surrounded by crazy currently. But we are seeing a lot of rhetoric coming out of the Democratic Socialists of America, just kind of their rise with some DSA candidates registering as Democrats and thus winning, you know, being able to win some of these elections. But the DSA chair, who was recently interviewed on Fox, was pretty open about their beliefs. They would like to abolish the Senate, defund the Pentagon, abolish prisons, and so forth. Not your standard Democratic platform. Even progressive Democrats aren't for abolishing the Senate. So my question is, on the Hill, you know, in D.C., how much traction, how much support is the DSA platform really getting among Democrats?
Well, if you're talking about among actual elected Democrats, the answer is very little. I mean, this is not something that appeals to any except for a very small clutch, primarily in the House of progressive legislators. When it comes to America writ large, there's this really strange disconnect that's happening right now, because if you went down the list of all of those specific policy positions and polled them all, you would not get an enormous amount of support for any of those things. I mean, if you go down that list, you're basically abolishing all of the basic structures of America as a political unit in the world today. It's a pie in the sky platform, to put it mildly. At the same time, a lot of these DSA-type progressives have been getting a lot of traction politically just because the Democratic brand is seen as so tarnished and so damaged by the party's inability to stand up to Donald Trump and to withstand specifically his return. And there's this enormous sort of insurgent anti-establishment energy among the voter base where they don't necessarily like these DSA candidates for any of that stuff that you're talking about right now, but they just see them as more willing to knife fight with the president and with Republicans than the Democrats that are in office right now. And it's a real problem. It's a problem for Democrats, and it's a problem that we've seen just you know, real recently. This is exactly the kind of thing that we saw in the wake of Trump's election in 2016, was you had a wave of real fury among the Democratic base at its own establishment that would have allowed a guy like this to come along and clean their clocks in the first place. They, you know, kind of swerved to the left on a bunch of these policy issues and in terms of a bunch of policy rhetoric specifically. And then that comes back to bite them a lot in the next couple cycles where Republicans hang things like defund the police around Democrats' necks and use it to sink them in a lot of winnable races. And I think what a lot of sort of more normie Democrats or more establishment Democrat types are worried about is seeing the same thing happen right now, that there's this massive backlash against the president, against what he's doing to the country in a lot of these areas, but that some of the people who are coming forward to channel that backlash are going to end up sparking a backlash of their own that then Republicans on the swing back of the pendulum will be able to capitalize another cycle or two down the road. And they do not seem to have a very good strategy for stalling that or preventing that, again, because some of these candidates are so good at channeling that kind of insurgent rage.
Thank you, Andrew Egger, as always, and we will talk again next week.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, so I had a buddy this weekend was doing yard work in his yard and unearthed...
Where else would he do it?
He's like helping in the bathroom. Someone else.
Oh.
His buddy goes to other people's homes, helps the elderly.
I see.
But in his own yard. And hornets can build nests, I guess, in... maybe up high, but anyway, they build them in the ground. And he disturbed a hornet's nest, but didn't know it, didn't see the hole, because it's this hole from the hornet's nest in the ground, until all of a sudden he heard a buzzing, and he felt like a sting on his back. He's like, ow! And then he looked, and there were hundreds of hornets swarming. And he took off running, and he's like swinging his, you know, clothes, like trying to swing his shirt around or whatever, and he's running and swinging his arms, and he's getting like attacked by these hornets. And by the time he made it up to the house, I guess they did abandon their chase. He didn't bring them into the house, but he had 6 hornet stings, which is, I mean, hornets are really, really bad. It's not a bee sting. And I had a honeybee sting the other day that drew blood. I didn't know honeybees could draw blood, but they do. So we got
went to high school with Drew Blood.
So we got 6 hornet stings. How many hornet stings does it take to kill you?
Well, more than 6.
Well, I thought it was 5 because I said, did you go to the hospital? He said, no. He goes, it hurt really bad. I said, did you cry? He said, no, he didn't cry. But they tried to put some salve on the stings that didn't really help. So he said he self-medicated. He took a couple of Advil and then started drinking. I'm like, are you serious? He's like, oh yeah. He's like, I started drinking wine and then I had some bourbon. He goes, because I was in so much pain. And then the toxins from the hornet stings can make you feel ill. And he did start to feel like kind of ill. So, and he didn't sleep well that night at all, obviously, but I thought 5 could kill you. How many do you think can kill you?
10.
Matthew?
I was going to say 1 in the right spot.
I imagine that if you have an allergy or something,
but
then...
not allergies, you know. Because we all saw My Girl. Honeybees can kill you if you have an allergy.
Yeah.
Assuming no allergy, a healthy adult.
15.
Yeah. I said 5. You can take well over 1,000 and you're going to be fine.
1,000 hornet stings?
Yes, it says... I've looked up on several different sites and it says adults... 1,000 plus stings based on the threshold of roughly 10 stings per pound of body weight. So that's a lot of stings, you know, like you can, if you're, you know, 170 pounds, you're looking at 1,700 hornet stings, which is a lot. So I feel like you're safe, but I was so off with that person dying from hornet stings.
Well, I'm glad your friend's still alive.
That's bad though.
This is a long live read for Rottler, by the way.
Does Rottler take care of hornets?
I know. I don't know. Because, I mean, maybe.
I mean, hornets can be a pest.
Yeah, and they're in the ground. Oh, they're a huge pest.
I didn't know they're in the ground.
Yeah. Hornets are bad. They're the bad ones. Because wasps hurt. Honeybees are sweet. And I, like I said, I did not think that this honeybee would hurt this bad. But I wanted to cry.
That is, you know, that's where the aliens from War of the Worlds came. They came up from the ground. started killing everybody.
Yeah, but didn't they kill everybody one at a time?
Yeah, you know I got a problem with that. We've talked about it.
That is not the most efficient way. One at a time?
Yeah, that was my...
That's like eating rice one at a time.
I love the movie. I think the Tom Cruise movie from 2005, I guess, something like that. It's a really good movie.
Except...
But man, it does bother me that these sophisticated aliens who had plotted this extermination of an entire planet for years and years and years, their most efficient way to kill everybody was to shoot them one by one with lasers. Just didn't...
We have a know-it-all texter who said those are yellow jackets.
Oh. All right, it is Shark Week. It is Shark Week right now. And our guy, we got a guy. We have a Shark Week guy.
We do.
Yeah, Keith Poe. He's a shark tagger, a conservationist, and he's a researcher out of Southern California. We got an alligator guy, and we have a shark guy. Well, Keith Poe is our shark guy, and he's always sending photos to Matt Pajeski. And we can't wait to talk to Keith when we come back
on the shark photos.
They're not like, they're not sexy photos.
Unless you consider sharks sexy.
Well, they are all naked. Keith Poe joins us next on KMOX. You know, it's Shark Week, and I'm just thinking to myself right now, we're playing this, and I'm guessing our next guest has probably heard that no less than 3 million times in his life. And every time he does any interview on any radio station, anywhere ever, he probably hears that song. It is the Chris and Amy Show, and it is Shark Week. That's right. It is Shark Week on Discovery. This has been going on for decades now. I used to watch it getting ready to go to college. I remember it'd be Shark Week, and then we were in college. The school year would start. And we are now joined by shark tagger, conservationist, and researcher out of Southern California, also on Discovery quite a bit during Shark Week. It is Keith Poe, who is with us on the show. Good morning, Keith. How you doing?
Great. And don't forget, you're going to need a bigger boat, baby.
So throwaway line. It was improvised. And it turned into the most iconic line from that movie. So, Keith, it's Shark Week. And like I said, when I was getting ready to go back to college every August, I feel like it happened a little later in the year than it does now. Maybe I'm wrong. But this is such a fun week. And I know for you, it's probably even more fun because this is your livelihood.
That's right. And getting to go out on the water and look at things like we're doing with this show coming on tonight with this Mako that they found out in Mexico that we're investigating. This shark blows everything away on all the charts, the Mako shark. Normally, the biggest Mako sharks that you find out there max out at 1,000 pounds and 12 feet. Now, this thing is such an extreme outlier. It's unbelievable. It was 15 feet. So if you take a Mako that's 12 feet, and it's 1,000 pounds. The largest, heaviest one that's ever been weighed was 1,323 pounds. And that was back in 2013. So, and once they reach 9 feet, every foot after that, they gain approximately 200 pounds. So if this thing is 5 or 3 feet bigger than the normal maxed out size of 12 feet and it's 13 or 15 feet, now you have a fish that's at least 600 pounds heavier. And if you put 600 on top, 1,300, now you have a Mako that's almost doubled in the normal weight of 1,000 pounds, the grander they call it, and it's approaching double that size at 2,000 pounds. And if you look at all the commercial landings and the sport fishing records worldwide, there's over 100,000 of them, and none of them get anywhere near close to this. So this thing is so massive and so large, we had to go investigate it, and we went all in on it. We had put everything we had into it to go find this animal and find out everything we could about it, and that's what the show is all about.
The show tonight on Discovery is called Biggest Mako on Earth. It is at 9:00 Central Time, and you can record it, you can watch it live. And Keith, why is the Mako shark, that's the one that you are most focused on in your career, is that correct?
It was early in my career because they're protected, and then once I started working with the researchers, then I had the permits that allowed me to start working with the white sharks. And last season, I tagged, actually went on 5 trips for the white sharks last season, and I'm about to go again in 30 days. And the tags are coming in the mail now. And with the white sharks, I saw 160 in 5 trips, and I picked out 6 of them to tag and put the spot tags on, and the tags last for up to 7 years. And it was 3 16-foot white sharks, 2 17-foot white sharks, and the largest one that was ever tagged. And that's 18 foot. And these sharks, a lot of times, these organizations, they'll do stretch measurements, and then a lot of them that are pulled out of the water, they'll be crane stretched. And those are all inflated numbers, and they have computer programs that inflate the numbers as well. When I measure them, those are true caliper-like measurements, and they're exact. And it's the largest one that's ever been tagged. And in 1 month, I'm going to go do it again because we found that new area of white sharks that was previously unknown. We're trying to find everything we can out about them, and finding that out through the largest matriarchs, the females, is the best way to do it. One of them that we named Kara, she did something that they normally never do, and she went all the way up to the Alaska border, spent several months, and then she went over by Hawaii. And another one left Southern California and went over halfway to Japan to the Gardner Pinnacle. So we found that quite interesting as well. So we're learning a lot of new behavior that we haven't observed before with them.
So quick question about the white sharks, because we've talked to you about that, but how do you tag an 18-foot white shark?
Yeah, how do you know? Because you say you've identified some you want to tag.
Yeah.
How do you know where to find them specifically?
And then how do you do it that they're swimming around?
Well, like the Jaws story, it centered around people being killed. And we had people that were being killed here on one of the local beaches, Surf Beach. And then there were some kayakers that were being attacked in their kayaks, hit and raised several feet in the air on their kayaks and destroying them. So I went up there and we started observing that area. And we found a massive group of white sharks. It's probably one of the largest congregations in the world of sub-adults and adults. And when I am attracting them, we use chum, attract them to the boat. Then I use a trash can full of rope and a hook and welding gloves. And then they take off and I fight them and I tire them out. It's kind of like breaking a horse, and I convince them to come to the side of the boat while it's underway. And then I take and attach the with four fasteners onto their dorsal fin, a spot tag that lasts up to 7-8 years.
So, okay, do they generally stay, like, okay, how big is the area they generally stay in, right? Because my understanding is they can swim forever and really long distances, but do they tend to collect in one area and stay there?
There's one that I tagged that I named after my last name. Her name was Poe Girl. We tracked her for 7 years. I've seen her three different times since I tagged her, and it was always in the exact same location again. And it's every other year because they have a 2-year migration cycle because their gestation period is 18 months. And generally what they'll do in my tagging location off Point Conception, California, is once they leave there and they've spent several months there, they'll go out halfway to Hawaii and Cabo. They'll spend 13, 16 months. And then she went every time around Cabo San Lucas into the Sea of Cortez, spent a few months, and we believe she had her pups there. Then she immediately returned straight back to where I tagged her, and she kept doing that, and she did it 3 different times over that 7 years, that exact same pattern. So, yes, they've come back to the exact same location, and it's not uncommon for me to see 40 different individuals there over a 3-day trip that are in the same exact location every year.
Have you ever, in the process of tagging a shark, just gotten in a situation where you're thinking, okay, this was bad, this was close, just, you know, where you could have died or the shark turned on you, did something that was unexpected?
Yes, I've had one that was a Mako that was 1,500 pounds, I believe, and that's estimated, not documented. That's a big difference people need to understand when they're looking at information. So she was 1,500 pounds, and I bolted a tag on her, named her after my daughter, Heather, and when I was fighting her, it took me many hours to fight her. She was so fierce. And in the middle of the night when I was fighting her, she stopped fighting. And she came up, swam up to the boat, stuck her head out of the water. She looked around, and when she saw me, she snapped her jaws really hard to threaten me and tell me that if she gets her shot, that she's going to take me out. She scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I've had them at the side of the boat before when they think they have a chance to try to bite me. They'll swing for me and try to do it. And I have to reach in their mouth and pull the hook out by hand. So it can be quite dangerous, but I think it's well worth the risk.
Do sharks, and you're talking about a Mako here, do they do the thing kind of like dogs do where they bite as a warning? They're not actually trying to bite you, but they're trying to let you know, hey, stay away from me. Do they do that?
Well, that's what that one big maker did. But the others, if you get close and you've detained them and subdued them, and you're trying to get them to work with you because they're so powerful, but they will take a shot at you and try to bite you because that's their hands. They're trying to let you know, let me go. They want to go. So nobody wants to be detained, especially if you're a wild animal. But I've had them, one that was a 11-foot, 3-inch mako off the backside of Catalina, where I was hand-feeding her a mako, and then I caught her and tagged her, and I tried to be as minimally invasive as possible. That's my job. And she came right back after I tagged her and released her and continued eating out of my hand. And that, I found, is a great success.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
Why is tagging so important?
Well, if you're trying to manage something and you don't know where it's going and what it's doing, then you can't manage it properly. And that's what it's all about. There's just a big mystery about these sharks, and they don't know what they're doing. We didn't know there was a new tribe up there. We didn't know they were spending years ago all that time out there in the middle of the Pacific. And understanding where their nurseries are at is vital to protecting those areas, and they're studying their migration routes and preferred habitats just for the management purpose.
So the show tonight is the biggest mako on Earth. It is on Discovery. It's at 9 o'clock. We are just now starting Shark Week. Is there something that people don't understand about sharks that you wish they did?
All I can say is if you've experienced what I've experienced, then it never gets old. Every time you see them, it's absolutely a joy. I'm like the little kid in a candy store, and they're just absolutely fascinating. And their behavior, their strength, their power, and unlocking all their little mysteries. It's like an aquatic Rubik's Cube, and I get to go investigate it and then share with the world and also help with the management process. So I absolutely love it.
Go watch it tonight on Discovery, Biggest Mako on Earth. It is at 9 o'clock tonight, our time, Central Time. And Keith Poe is right there in the thick of it. And we appreciate you. We love talking sharks with you. So thank you again for being with us, Keith.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
That is Keith Poe. He is a shark tagger and a conservationist. He's out of Southern California, and he's a lot of fun and passionate about sharks. I love it. I love talking to people who are passionate about stuff like that and stuff that is interesting to the rest of us, but we don't really ever explore it unless we're watching Shark Week.
Right.
Know what I mean?
Remember the alligator guy? He was similar.
Oh, yeah. Rob. Alligator Rob.
Alligator Rob.
That's why I said we got an alligator guy. We have a shark guy. What do we need next?
We have a sinkhole guy.
That's Sean Malone.
Yeah.
He's an everything guy, though.
Yeah, what do we need next?
Bacteria guy.
We need a bacteria guy.
I don't know.
We need a fungus guy.
Yeah.
Or a fungi guy?
A worm guy. We had screwworm and tapeworms.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Those aren't the good kind of worms.
No.
They're not the earthworms, you know?
No.
So tonight, biggest mako on Earth. It's on Discovery at 9 o'clock. It is Shark Week, baby. I love this time of year. It's Chris and Amy on KMOX. Gas House Gang at 12.
We have an update from the know-it-all texter and from my buddy who listens to the Chris and Amy show. It was indeed hornets. He was attacked by hornets. Not hornets, yellow jackets. I had said hornets. It was a hornet nest in the ground, but hornets' nests in the ground are really... they're yellow jackets. They're not hornets. And so, update on the number. Bad news. Good news. It will take at least 1,500 yellow jacket stings. I mean, minimum. You're going to probably need to be over 2,000
to
die from yellow jacket stings.
Most of us will never be in that situation.
Yeah, he got six, which was bad.
That's good. You're not going to get my girl this time.
Nope.
So the Odyssey, the second weekend of the Odyssey was strong, about $87 million in North America, $87 million, that is, in North America, which brings the worldwide total for this Christopher Nolan movie to almost $640 million. Mm. This thing is going to do very well. And, I mean, it already has, but it might end up breaking some records here. Now, we talked about the format. We had Richard Roper on, the film critic, last week talking about the optimal format to view it, which is the IMAX 70 millimeter. Because there's a 70 millimeter, there's IMAX, and then there's IMAX 70 millimeter, which is like the pinnacle of it.
And there's what, 25?
25 in the country. There is one in Indianapolis. There is one in Chicago. And I looked at movie times when I was up there. It's in the suburbs. It's a town called Woodridge. And it's probably 30 minutes outside the city. And I've actually been to this theater before. I didn't know that they had the 70 millimeter IMAX thing. So I was curious, and I looked at movie times. They are literally showing this thing 24 hours a day.
That's
so
awesome.
So you can go at 2:30 in the morning to a show.
That's
like you
awesome.
Could go at 7:45. And right now, the 2:30 a.m., later tonight, early tomorrow, there is nothing available.
Oh, my gosh.
There are zero available seats. The only thing available are the, the wheelchair spaces.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's crazy. And I just read a story on CSN or CNBC about the IMAX 70 millimeter, which is becoming very, very popular, and people are traveling great distances. And there's an expectation that this will stay in the theaters for months just so people can have an opportunity.
Yeah.
They talked to a guy from St. Louis, Mike Rolfing, who's 39 years old. He, his wife, and three kids drove 900 miles round trip in a minivan to go see this movie in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Wow.
And he said it was totally worth it. I want to know, maybe he couldn't get a time in Chicago, which is closer, or Indianapolis, which is closer, or maybe they had family in Michigan, but that's 900 mile road trip, which
committed.
He said was totally worth it.
Wow. Well, there you go. I love the 24 hour movie. I like when things are open 24 hours. Makes me sad when I see McDonald's or gas stations closed.
I agree with you.
It's kind of sad.
Coffee Cartel, when it was open in the Central West End, 24 hours. But how do you... I don't know about getting out of a movie at 5:30 in the morning. So that's...
Yeah, then what do you do? Do you go to bed?
Because I would still be up. I would probably be up until 2:30. And then the movie's over at 5:30, and now you get home at 6. That's like working a night shift.
Yeah. Well, you should try it. See what happens.
No, I'm not going to do it.
See what you do. You get out of the movie and go, what am I going to do?
I don't think I'm going to do it. I would love to, though. I do want to do one of the English Premier League games. You go to a bar like Amsterdam, and they have a game at 6 a.m.
No, that's fun.
I've always wanted to do that, and I never have. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
But I think you would change your mind when your alarm went off at 5.
I'd be like, no, I'm not doing this.
I don't
want to
be here right now.
Ridiculous. All right. Have a great rest of your day.
Hey,
stay cool out there if you can. I'm not talking to you. I was talking to the people. Amy. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Yes, we will.
Right here. If you missed anything, you know where to get it. KMOX.com, Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts. Back tomorrow, 9 o'clock for the Chris and Amy Show. But coming up next, it is the Gas House Gang on KMOX.